I certainly have thoughts about Gladiator 2, I'll say that.
I'm going to be, I'm the Gladiator 2 defender here. I'm
Gladiator
on board.
Gladiator 2 this is... apologist.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's going to be like the reenactment of the Battle of Zarma. Pat might cause an upset.
Just call me a third century Christian bishop because I'm doing apologia all over the place here, baby.
Pat Eusebius Wyman.
I'm more of a Tertullian myself, but that's, you know.
Hello and welcome to Masters of Our Domain, the podcast which was formerly about the hit 90s sitcom Seinfeld and is now about the classical world and stuff about the classical world and things of that nature. I'm Milo Edwards and I'm joined as ever by my delightful co-hosts Phoebe Warren and Patrick Wyman. How are we doing?
We're doing okay. I'm speaking for Pat here.
Yeah, it's been quite some time since I've worn pants with any structural integrity at all, which for me, that's a huge win.
Yeah, I've got a hard bra on. I'm not that happy about it, but...
Never hard bra.
Never go
You've got two kinds. You've got the soft A cup and the hard bra. That's
that's right.
Stop, Jesus, man.
This time between Christmas and New Year's, there should be no structural integrity in any item of clothing.
Mm-hmm.
That's what this is for. I feel disgusting right now, and I think that's appropriate.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. A zipper should be punishable by a short prison sentence.
You're embracing the Gladiator 2 little gay emperors lifestyle by wearing clothes with no structure whatsoever.
None.
Flowy
zero.
Robes.
Just get me a little monkey and I'm here for it. One little guy.
We should all be tunic maxing this Saturnalia.
I'm still trying to think of some wordplay about the church fathers rebranding themselves as the church daddies, and that's all I've got.
Mm. Church zaddies, actually.
The church zaddies, fine.
Yeah.
I think that works pretty well.
To be fair, the cardinals are kind of tunic maxing. They have embraced the Christmas lifestyle. They've always got their comfies on.
I'm gonna. This is just a suggestion for any of our cardinal listeners out there. Mm. Next time they host an orgy in Rome, call it their very own Council of Nicaea.
Yeah,
just throwing that out there.
The Council of Nice, got a history. 69ing this.
Just call me Arius for the way I'm getting my back blown out here. That's a niche one.
The thing about the cardinal tunics is they're not actually cozy maxing, and it's quite the way that you think, because you have to wear some pretty serious shape garments under the cardinal under the cardinal's costume. Otherwise, you're getting some lumps and bumps.
He's got a pair of span tenons under here.
Yeah, you joke. Have you ever seen the Vatican Spanx? It's made of a proprietary material. It is stronger elastic than any other Spanx.
Well, they're hair lined to give you that real.
I have not the foggiest idea whether you're joking or not.
Oh, I'm totally joking. I don't think there's a real thing called the Vatican Spanx.
Pan Roy strikes again.
Because my follow up here was going to be that I see a real opportunity for Kim Kardashian and Skims to step into a new market that, like, you know, they've gotten deals with major sporting organizations, celebrities. Why not the Catholic Church?
Why not the cardinal, the coveted cardinal partnership?
I see
huge opportunities for cross market integration, branding opportunities, merch. A lot of merch you could do there. Imagine, a 77-year-old Filipino grandmother shows up on pilgrimage to the Holy See. What's she going to do? She's going to buy some branded Skims, some cardinal branded Skims.
Lot of market for it in the hot, depressed slag community as well.
That's absolutely true. Yeah. Look, I'm just saying, should we be doing, branding and partnerships for the Vatican? Not no.
Yeah,
it's not a no.
Could the Valor be doing more to reach out to the thick community?
It's not a hard bra, no.
Yeah, well, I'd like to know, what is the Vatican's position on thick thighs save lives? That's the that's really something I'd like to know.
I think that's like kind of filed away with the new position on purgatory. They're not clear.
Yeah. We're gonna need an encyclical on this.
Thick thighs don't send you to hell, but we don't know what they do.
Yeah, it's like upon Irish school teacher being like, "Do Pope has clarified his position on thick thighs?" I don't know why I have to read this out to 8-year olds, but apparently I do. That's what the school, that's what the local classes have told me.
Just hanging out in Ennis, just hearing the Pope's new opinion on Skims, like this.
Connell, once again, the Pope has not said anything about yo-yos. I can't make that any clearer.
Joseph, put the yo-yo away. We don't have an encyclical on that.
The yo-yo is in limbo, isn't it? It is the purgatory toy.
Yeah, it is. It's neither up nor down, and as such is a tool of Satan.
Yeah, that's right. You're sort of like, you've got the three Venn diagram sections. You've got tools of Satan, things that are either neither up nor down, and in the middle you've got the Duke of York.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Duke of York was indeed a tool of Satan.
Yeah, correct.
That's why he was so grand.
But we're not here to talk about the Duke of York or his most recent incarnation. We are here to talk about Gladiator 2 because we all watched this movie. We all watched the same copy that Andrew Neil watched, apparently. I don't know if either of you saw this. But Andrew Neil went on some, this is like an insane British right-wing journalist, went on some rant on Twitter about how, you know, they've put all of these like woke warnings into movies now. He's like, I was watching Gladiator 2, and every time someone had a glass of wine, it said alcohol consumption is injurious to health. And then various people were like, Andrew Neil is watching a torrented Indian version of the film. And then I was like, oh, that's why that kept coming up.
Look, it's nice to know that they culturally translate for different markets. That does feel woke, but not in the way he thought.
Yeah, yeah. I kind of assumed it was like a version that had been cut for an Emirati airline or something. It had weird, but there's a bit in the movie where someone gets beheaded and it cuts from just as they're about to do it to then like the head falling on the ground in a way that is like, it's such a harsh cut that it absolutely wasn't in the original movie.
Yeah,
you say that, but there's a bit which I think a little bit belies the idea that they try to kind of sanitize any beheading.
Yeah, it was kind of inconsistent. Like there were some violent bits that had definitely been censored, but then there were other bits that had been left in, and I wasn't really sure. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is sort of irrelevant to the listener because this is purely specific to the copy of it that we watched. I don't think this is. Yeah. I don't think this was an artistic choice by Ridley Scott. But if you're looking for a recommend on the Indian download version of Gladiator 2, I'm not sure I can wholeheartedly recommend it. I actually would have been quite happy to go to the cinema to watch it, but I A, didn't have time, and B, retrospectively having watched the movie, I'm very glad that I didn't.
Yeah, I'm quite glad that I didn't as well. I was going to go to a parent and baby screening of it. I'm quite glad I didn't do that. It was difficult enough keeping the baby amused during conclave. And that's like very appealing to babies. That's got lots of like bright red, lots of comfy maxing.
Yeah. Well, and also the Catholic Church, they're all like big babies, aren't they?
Mm-hmm.
They're just sort of like, you know, bald men in sort of baby grows who live on their own and never have sex. They're baby maxing.
Babies don't live on their own. A baby famously can't live on their own.
Baby kibbutz, a kibaby, where just everyone is a baby.
I'm going to put it this way. I like what you're trying to do here.
Yeah.
I like the approach. I'm afraid the end product, much like the spruce goose or other gigantic airplanes, has
some conceptual flaws. Mm. Yeah. It's got some flaws for sure.
Yeah.
But as always, dedication to the bit, 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
And that's all I aim for.
So I think I'm the only person who liked this movie. Actually, not to, like, really genuinely enjoyed pretty much everything about it.
Did you? That's interesting.
I did, yeah. I hear the incredulity in your voice. Yeah.
I've got a bit of incredulity.
Pat Scott, you can't hear it, but Patrick's pockets are jangling. They're full of rupees.
That's true.
He's on the payroll of big Indian edit of Gladiator 2.
Big camera.
I at one point did get an email from Paramount asking if I would promote the show on my show. And they're like, but you can't say anything bad about it. I'm like, well, I'm not going to promise that. That's not part of my deal. I do have some minor critiques, but overall, I really enjoyed it.
Pat coming out as a surprise normal people head.
I did like normal people. I do love I do love an Irish actor. But no, it's mostly the reason I liked it.
Okay.
Is there are two reasons. A, it is a fantastic Ridley Scott movie. In the sense that it does exactly what Ridley Scott sets out to do. That's number one. Number two, I can't remember if I said A or B, and now that's fucking with my head a little bit. Item number two, I think it has far more interesting things to say about the Roman Empire than practically any other bit of media on this topic that gets put into a movie theater. I think we talked a lot about Rome and its benefits and drawbacks when we were talking about the Rome series. We talked about the lack of a perspective on this in Those About to Die. I think Gladiator 2 actually has some interesting things to say about not just Rome, but empire in general. Who pays the price and whether it's worth it.
Yeah, yeah. I will caveat this by saying it's hands down better than Those About to Die. I don't think either of us would dispute that.
No, we're not disputing that at all.
I mean, I had so many inappropriate points of comparison for something that's better than Those About to Die. Like, that is the lowest possible bar you could clear. Actually, no, the Megalopolis bar is lower.
That is a very low bar indeed.
I think that's true. I do agree with you, Pat, to an extent. I think that it's in terms of like what it has to say about the Roman Empire and what it has to say about empire in general is a little bit undermined by the way it ends.
Disagree.
That's interesting.
But continue your point.
I find the kind of the sort of the Lord of the Rings ass ending was, I think, undermined anything.
That was a little bit crazy. The ending,
like, yeah. What man? Like I said, we can get into it. I would say that I did have a little bit of trouble. I did have a little bit of trouble following it. So quite a lot of my notes are me sort of exhibiting a certain amount of confusion. So I'd be interested if this is a kind of, you know, feature, or if this is a kind of Roy bug thing going on.
Yeah, it felt to me like it was kind of, it had the beats of a Ridley Scott movie, in that it had the big set pieces, and it's sort of like, and in that way it had the things that Gladiator 1 had, like the big highly constructed like battle scenes and whatever. But then what it lacked as a movie was you having any investment in any of the characters at all. I was so they just kept throwing new people in, and I'm like, who is this guy? I found, whilst I kind of like Paul Mescal as a guy, but I didn't find Paul Mescal particularly believable as sort of like action hero. He's too hackney fuckboy for that. There's something, he's believable in that kind of like love interest role, but like in the sort of like action lead role, I don't know. Something about it doesn't quite work.
Well, I will repeat what I said in the chat about the lead actors. All of them behave like they're recording cameos in order to help with a large tax bill. I think that's the biggest energy
what,
I'm getting.
What is a movie but a very long cameo?
A very long cameo. Ah, that's so true. I like Mescal. I think he's got a lot of range as an actor, and I But I do agree with you, Mila. It is a bit odd that someone this like thigh-y, because the man's got a fine set of thighs. He's like, ask him where he comes down on the side of, you know, whether or not thick thighs save lives.
We know his answer.
Well, as a good Irish man, he would presumably be very in favor of a pair of Vatican Spanx.
Well, this is what we'd think. But I mean, but the problem is, if there's any kind of disagreement, then we could be looking at a, you know, a kind of thick thigh schism.
Which you wouldn't want, only hope
that Paul ends up on the right side of that schism.
The Avignon Chapacy.
Yeah. you don't want to end up as a thick thigh heretic.
No, you don't want to end up thick thigh excommunicated.
I'm just imagining thick thigh iconoclasm at this point and just destroying idols of thick thighs, of which there are many in our 21st century society.
I love that this is becoming the running riff of the episode, and it's the one riff that bears no relation to any of the material whatsoever.
No. Paul Mescal, great thighs. We've established this. This is our connection. Are there any other characters with great thighs in this movie? The baboons, great thighs.
Yep.
CGI baboons.
Pedro Pascal's got pretty good thighs.
Yeah, he does.
Mm-hmm.
I don't reject his thighs. Yeah. Denzel's got pretty good thighs for a man of his age.
Yeah. Now he is comfy maxing. That man is, the garments are so flowing on Denzel.
Oh, again, you say that, but he also is wearing some very, very heavy hoops. And those are, to me, those are not all night hoops. Those are 6-hour hoops.
Yeah. He's Denzel Washington spiritually scouse, ? He's got his rollers in. He's off for a big night out later. He's cutting about Washington. The forum in his pajamas. Yeah.
He's got a dry robe.
Yeah. Danielle Washington. There you go. Right. I got to start this business up with the gladiators because I'm going to embargoes later. Kevin's picking me up.
That's pretty good energy. The kind of energy for somebody who has tickets to the Everton match, but got too drunk to get there.
Let's be serious for a second. Let's just really be serious for a minute.
Yeah. Okay. So the CGI baboons.
We're starting with the CGI baboons? Okay, cool, fine.
I feel like I want to create a category of things that I'm not gonna emphasize in the course of talking about this movie.
Sure. So these are like your stray observations.
Yeah, CGI baboons, sharks in the Colosseum, guy reading newspaper. I don't care about any of that. Give it to me. Absolutely, give it to me. Give me the weirdest CGI baboons. Give me Paul Mescal biting a baboon. I'm good with that.
Not baboons. They're a kind of horrible sort of baboon man hybrid.
Don't care, Phoebe. I feel like I was pretty clear about this.
They look like Star Wars creatures.
Don't care. That's okay. Cool as shit. Cool as shit. Love it. Absolutely love it. Here for that. I'm here for the sharks because I feel like, okay, here's my reasoning as to why I think those things are okay in the context of this movie. You have to culturally translate Roman violence for your audience. Because the things that the Romans actually found appealing are so fucking horrifying to modern people that you could not put it on a screen. So like killing animals in the ways that the Romans did, which was the crowd's favorite thing. You can't really do that in a 21st century movie.
Sure.
You can have CGI baboons. Can do that. You can't really do trained gladiators or ferocious predators eating people in the Colosseum. Just going to town on hopelessly outmatched criminals, Christians, enslaved people, whatever. Can't do that.
No.
Sharks? Can do sharks. So I think
the first ever Australian to be executed in the Colosseum, thrown into the shark pit. Oh, no.
The Romans would have loved Steve Irwin's death. They would have gone crazy for that. Too soon? Still probably too soon.
Still probably just about.
Not
just
too soon for the Romans.
Not too soon for the Romans. They'd have been into it. Also, I love that you said hopelessly outmatched. I love that that's the issue for you. Like, if they'd got somebody who could sort of pretty much like hold their own against a tiger, then that would have been fine.
No, I think that modern people, when they look at Roman violence, the completely outmatched nature of it is the most horrifying bit. That, like, it's okay to make people fight as long as it's fair. I think modern people are pretty on board with that. And so that's why there's so much emphasis on gladiators, is because you get to have what are effectively fair fights with all the blood and gore that you want without having to feel bad about the inherent power dynamic. And so I'm okay with doing violence that looks shocking to modern people, even if it's ahistorical, sure, to get across the point that they were absolute fucking junkies for blood.
Structurally, a tiger has much more privilege than a person. For one thing, they're striped.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They're big striped boys.
They are. They
better
are
teeth.
Better boys. Teeth.
Mm-hmm. Better, actually, better in the Roman era.
Tail.
So there is a set of human remains from, I believe, York, Roman, late Roman, like third, maybe into the fourth century. There's a scapula, so a shoulder blade, that has what is very obviously a tooth mark from a tiger in it. Like, they brought a tiger all the way to York to kill a dude in front of a crowd.
I mean,
and that's why it's called Tiger now. But, let me tell you, it gets pretty violent in there.
This is the thing that's put, I mean, like, you say like that this was like a kind of, you know, common occurrence, but maybe that tiger was just really pissed off. Like, it had been told that it was going on a holiday, and then at the last minute it was said, oh, you know, I gotta go on a little trip to York. It's actually really lovely. It's a cathedral city. It's got some it's got some really lovely sights. And the tiger has shown up with his beach bag. And his SPF. He is, as far as he's concerned, he's been, you know, he was all set for Mallorca.
Mm-hmm. And instead, he ends up in fucking Eberrockham. Who wanted that? Who asked for that?
Not that.
Yeah. Imagine being a tiger, being taken on this enormously long journey, and you got to show up in fucking York, man. Yeah. Like, yeah. And not only do you have to, of course, you're going to eat a guy.
I was like, you know what? It's a bit brisk, yeah, isn't it? Does it? It's gonna rain again. Are you joking?
Yeah, York is catching a lot of strays in our recording today, and I feel bad for that.
I brought my swimsuit. it is a lovely city, but I wouldn't care for it myself. Were I a tiger?
Were you a tiger living 1,700 years ago? You too would not want to be transported from your home across the entirety of the Roman world to eat a guy in front of a crowd in New York. That would not be my preference.
No, I could have done that in my own back garden.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's a great savannah activity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's a bustler's holiday for a tiger.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I think my general point, to the extent that there is one, is I'm okay with them culturally translating Roman violence for a modern audience to get across the shocking nature of it.
Okay,
and I'm okay with this in pretty much any gladiator related bit of media, that actual Roman violence would be so off-putting to a modern audience that you could not, it wouldn't even make sense to people.
I think that's really interesting. And I think that's very correct. And it does, as I remember when we were talking about those about to die and how interesting it is that the thing that they can think of, which is like the most horrifying thing for a contemporary audience, is something that that a Roman audience would have also found completely horrifying, which was executing the kid. So it's quite interesting sort of seeing where these like distinctions and boundaries lie in the culture. But and honestly, this is a really interesting point, and this is a really smart point. And one that I feel is a little bit undermined by some of my notes, shall we say?
Let's hear. I want to hear your notes. Your notes are always fucking gold.
Should we go through the plot?
They're always so good.
Should we go through the plot and then I'll do my notes?
Yeah. Yeah.
The notes will follow.
Right. Yeah. So we're 16 years after the end of the first movie. And Rome is ruled by the two little gay emperors, Gator and Caracalla.
By fucking Roman Jedward.
Yeah, Roman Jedward.
Roman zombie Jedward.
I feel like I did make a similar comment to Annabelle while I was watching it and she rolled her eyes. So I'm glad that once again, brain in a jar, we're operating on the same principles there. It's like, what if Domitian, but two? And also more mental. That's but what they're more, going for
more
here.
More Caligula-y, I feel.
Yeah, yeah. I don't really know anything about Gator and Caracalla. Do either of you?
I do. I've got some fun stuff about Gator and Caracalla. This is a really interesting interpretation of them, by the way, because they're like, because both of them were soldiers. I don't think they were either of them, even according to their kind of like more sort of hostile contemporary critics, would have been down the kind of the conniving twink route. They were the sons of Septimius Severus, who was the only one of the Roman emperors who was born in Africa. So he's called the African Emperor, even though that probably doesn't have like much meaning in terms of like what his like ethnic background would have been, or like how we would have understood that to be. But Caracalla did have his brother killed, or almost certainly has, but his brother died when they were both emperor, and he almost certainly had him killed, and I have no idea.
Let's just say met with an unfortunate accident.
Let's just say, and there is a really fun, probably apocryphal story, which occasions the first. So far as I'm aware, the first like deliberate historical outside of a Roman comedy use of a Roman pun, or certainly Roman wordplay, which is after Gator was killed, after he died, the Senate were consulting with Caracalla about whether or not he wanted his brother to be added to the pantheon of Roman gods, and if we want people to start, you know, doing sacrifices on behalf of Gator, is he gonna get the full apotheosis treatment? You know, is it, you know, the whole thing, the Skims collab, you know, all of it. And his response was, "Sit divus dum non sit vivus," and he meant this as a piece of wordplay, and you can roughly translate this as, he can be a divus as long as he's not alivus. And yeah, I have no idea of whether or not this is apocryphal,
but this divus,
we do not want him alivus. Caracalla was responsible for a bunch of Roman building projects. There are some massive and excellent baths built by Caracalla towards like the end of the Appian Way. They're really, really cool. Really worth seeing if you find yourself in Rome.
Also, I believe used it as a set in the second John Wick movie. That's the real claim to fame.
So they are quite interesting emperors to have chosen, particularly since they wanted to go down the sort of decadent kind of, it's like the kind of, it, there's a sort of a Skins series 4 vibe hovering over the twin emperors. When it was good, when they've kind of given up the ghost, and like Effie's a main character. I think that's what we're looking at. Effie is kind of off screen, kind of, you know, sort of, you know, doing kind of big eyes.
The Roman princess Effie.
Yeah.
The Caracalla also was responsible for one of, aside from the baths, the other big thing Caracalla did was promote the legislation that made everybody living in the Roman Empire Roman citizens. Mm. So it collapsed the distinction between Roman citizens and non-citizens and peregrini, or foreigners. So he did it not because he wanted everybody to be Roman, but for tax reasons. Sure. So you could tax them harder if they were Roman citizens. So not an entirely disinterested move, but a very important one in kind of setting the framework for the legal and cultural framework for the later Roman Empire. Mm. So very interesting, the Edict of Caracalla. yeah, and that's when Roman society became formally divided by distinctions of wealth rather than possession of Roman citizenship.
Which is super interesting, and something that considering the nature and the context of the action of this film, probably would have been quite an interesting inclusion.
It might have been a more interesting reason for Caracalla to get killed. It might have been.
I think it's Gator that gets killed, I think.
Well, they both get killed in the end, don't they?
Yeah. But like the one, who gets the full fucking. Who is this that happens to? Is it one of Crassus's sons that has his head clattered off and ends up being used in the play?
Oh, I don't know.
It's like
one,
this
one
kind
of Crassus's
like...
sons. You mean Catalina?
I do indeed mean Catalina. I mean Shia LaBeouf. During the disastrous incursion into Carrie, somebody, I believe, related to Crassus. There's this like terrific ghoulish story.
Yeah. He gets his head cut off and they send it back, right?
No, it's the story about his head clattered off him, and then it kind of goes sort of flying and it lands in a theater where they're performing a production of the Bacchae, and the lead actor picks the head up and starts like acting with the head. I'm sure this isn't.
Oh my god, it's like that guy in Edinburgh on Halloween.
What?
Did you not hear about that? There was a guy in it's actually kind of a sad story, but it is also grimly funny. There was this guy in Edinburgh who got decapitated by a bus in like an accident, but the head somehow just got left in the road, and some people found it and they thought it was a Halloween prank, because you would think that if you found a severed head in the road with like no police around it, or like, and so there were like some people like running around with this head because they genuinely thought it was like a prop or something. And then it all came out that it was actually a real guy who'd unfortunately been killed in this horrific accident, and that was his head. But it's almost like a philosophical thought experiment, because no one involved really thought they were doing anything wrong. But, yeah, crazy.
That's one of the worst things I've ever heard.
Yeah, it was meant to. I can't believe neither of you heard about this. Yeah, it was crazy.
Milo, is it really a surprise that I have shielded myself from this information up until now?
True.
is that really a shock to you?
Yeah.
Let's do the plot. Let's do the plot of Gladiator 2. Yeah.
What plot? It doesn't matter. Yeah, it's not true. Important.
It doesn't matter.
Yeah. That is the position you are going to have to take, Patrick, because. Okay,
I'm invested. I'll go to town on this.
All right, I'm going to do my best here. So I'm going to try not to read it out as long as it is in the summary. So sure. Basically, yeah, you've got the Roman Jedward, the gay little emperors. Then you've got Pedro Pascal, General Acacius, who has been sent to conquer Numidia. Numidia, surely already a Roman province at this point.
Very much
has
so.
Been for 150 years by this point. Yeah.
That was my first buzzed. Of the movie. Yeah, big me getting it. That's the sound of me getting electrically shocked by this movie. So Pedro Pascal goes off to Numidia, conquers Numidia 150 years late, and then he takes Paul Mescal prisoner, who is defending Numidia, and it seems that it's never occurred to Pedro Pascal it's never occurred to Paul Mescal that he's not from Numidia, despite the fact that he's a completely different ethnicity to everyone else there.
Yeah, so this is the part that is very early on that I started to get kind of baffled, because we do find out who Paul Mescal is. He is Lucius, he is Prince Girly Hair from the first film, mm-hmm. who has been sent away for fear of reprisals, because he is, yeah, because people are just going to want to torture him for his hair care secrets. My problem with this is that he surely must have remembered this happening, but it does sort of show him discovering it as if for the first time. Also, there is a reveal at the end that he is Maximus's son, and his mother is Lucilla, the non-conniving MILF, but still a MILF from the first film. I actually
have white hat MILF.
Yeah, a kind of a neutral MILF, a kind of Swiss, sort of Switzerland MILF.
Neutral MILF hotel. Yeah, do something with that. Sure. Yeah.
Well, you know, if you are a neutral MILF, then you are on the side of tyranny. I think that
the neutral MILF negotiating peace between Hitler and the West.
The neutral MILF hotel is on the side of tyranny, and you know that's just something that we're just going to have to make our peace with.
Well, don't ask about they got all that gold in their safe.
No, all those cuckoo clocks. Yeah, fucking yeah.
We've finally broken, Patrick. We're 36 minutes in.
Cowbells.
That's almost a new record for how long it's taken.
I thought it was so the big reveal is that he is Maximus's son. I also have put as a note, it's interesting that the conniving MILF in this film is playing exactly the same role as the only MILF in the previous film. But then I realized that it is in fact exactly the same woman. Playing the same character. So it's revealed that he is Maximus and Lucilla's son, right? Even though I thought it was made fairly explicit in the first film that Lucius is the product of incestuous rape by Commodus. That's why he's all weird about, like, it's a bit of a coincidence, isn't it? Because she's only shagged Maximus like once, and it can't have been 12 years ago because he was been married to his wife. I'm not happy about this.
Decimus Meridius would not cheat on his wife, and I want that on the record.
He would not cheat on his wife. Like, if nothing else,
guy.
He was the ultimate wife. If you're cutting around saying that you're the husband to a murdered wife, that is wife guy supremo behavior.
Yeah.
All right, so
you're doing it on Hinge to get sympathy, you know. Two truths and a lie. Husband to a murdered wife, father to a murdered son, and I won't have my vengeance in this life.
Oh, very good. Yeah. I mean, that is how you end up on the are we dating the same guy, I think. If you start doing that. So what I've put here is, so we see Paul Mascal's girlfriend, who appears to be a kind of soldier of some description.
Yeah, she's kind of like Xena warrior princess.
Yeah. And I have put, what's that on her chin? Because I didn't.
So I think it's supposed to be
a kind of warrior tattoo.
No, I think it's a reference to Berber women often have facial tattoos.
See, this is I think
today.
This is, I think, quite interesting because, obviously, Numidia is the kind of the shorthand for non-specifically racist noble savagery in Those About to Die. Mm-hmm. And they're sort of doing the same thing here. And I want to know at what point it was in the writers' rooms of these various cultural products, did Numidia become that for them? Is there like a kind of package, like a kind of ancient world package that gets like released like once a year, and they kind of open it and they go, oh, everything's got to be about Numidia now. So that makes no sense.
Along these lines, I feel like there was also a memo that went around that said that we're going to replace conniving MILFs with conniving twinks.
Yes. Mm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. So we,
that's, conniving that twink is back. The
so
stock
we don't,
is
we don't get, yeah. we don't get a conniving MILF. We don't even get, we get a MILF, but she's also really the noble matron, I would say. So what I observed here in the pantomime MILF, yeah, there are two halves of her. One's in a cow. She's stuck in the cow. She's got to get her stepson to get her out.
Two blokes in the big MILF costume.
Yeah, see, that's the big problem with maternal mortality is that it's a MILF shortage.
Yeah, it's an absolute disaster. So what I've put here, right, is that Paul Mescal makes the category error that men in films about the ancient world quite often make, which is that he is living this extremely lovely, wholesome existence with his beautiful wife on his little homestead with the chickens and the goats and so on. So if you are a guy in the ancient world who is not an emperor, right, and somebody approaches you with chickens and goats and a beautiful woman, you run in the opposite direction because it's a fucking trap. You have to be living a kind of awful, dissolute, grim lifestyle. You can't be cutting about with your chickens and your goats and your beautiful wife, who I did time this. Beautiful wife buys the farm in the first 13 minutes. And I like this. I think this is fun because in the intervening 24, 25 years since the first Gladiator film came out, there's been not loads, but there's been some progress in filmmaking and, you know, narrative construction. You know, that's there's certainly a period of time has passed, and it's become a little bit eyebrow raising and a kind of a known, like, boring hackneyed trope for a woman to die horribly in service of a male character's narrative arc. In the year 2000, that was just like, that's fucking meat. That's fucking meat and drink. But in the intervening 25 years, there's been a bit of a, could we maybe give the woman, you know, maybe a story of her own, like some kind of internal motivation. Does she really need to die or get raped and then die in order to advance one of her close male relatives' stories? Are we still really doing that? And I sort of respect old Ridley for really just, he's really still like flying the flag for that particular trope. He's not letting it go anytime soon. Ridley Scott sees a female character and he's like, absolutely not. Absolutely fucking not. Get rid of her immediately.
But this is the great irony of Ridley Scott movies is he, because Alien, right? So he made a movie with one of the most compelling female protagonists of all time.
Would you like to know my fun alien fact in this regard? Ripley was written as a man.
That makes a lot of sense.
And then they decided to make her a woman without making any changes to the script early on in the production. And this was Ridley Scott's decision to do that, but she was not originally a female character.
Okay, so that's number one. Number two, The Last Duel is probably one of the most interesting explorations of gender dynamics and gendered violence in history that I can ever remember. And then so Ridley Scott does that, and then he does this.
What's so interesting about it in a way is that I guess it is sort of a repetition of the trope from Gladiator 1, where you've got, you know, the wife and the child horrifically murdered. But somehow it's done in this movie with even less pathos than the first time. There's something about the way he goes back to his farm and then he finds them and there's like the charred remains and like he's kind of there's something kind of affecting about it. Whereas like this one, it's just like, you know, wife that you've met literally 2 minutes ago gets like bonked with an arrow while she's doing her like Xena warrior princess thing, and then he like goes and finds her body in the sea. There's like this sort of weird, like she like falls off the wall into the sea, and then there's like these Roman soldiers just kind of letting him do that and then being like, no, but seriously, you are a slave now.
He doesn't even think about her in slow motion.
See, I'm into it. I'm into all of it. I'm here for it. All right. Go into the sea. Find her body in the sea. Absolutely. For me, that works. I'm feeling it.
Why is Paul Mescal, who was a Roman boy, and presumably, since they don't give any explanation of why he would have like lost his memory or not remember what had happened when he was about like 12 years old, why is he involved in what is heavily suggested to be a kind of anti, sort of, not just like a kind of military anti-Roman rebellion, but like an ideological anti-Roman rebellion? Why is he involved in that?
Yeah, because they don't.
Because they fucking left him. He was sent away from home. Like, of course he's got some trauma there. There's some issues that he's trying to work through by fighting against Rome. I'm okay with that. I don't think that's a plot hole.
Okay.
Yeah, because they could have given him the sort of like, you know, the sensual Mashalar white boy plot line. They could have given him the Lawrence of Arabia type. Yeah. Like, I actually love Numidia. It's sick. And actually, it's bang out of order what the Romans have been doing to you. Yeah. And even though
really
I am
Roman,
samurai
energy.
Yeah. I do actually, I now think, you know, I'm gonna wear all the gear. I'm gonna become as anti-Roman. Obviously I will be going home for Saturnalia because I love Mum's Dormouse, but I'm gonna be back. I'm gonna be back in the rebellion. Fucking January 1st, you will see me. You will see it, Juba. I see you looking at me. I will be back here, I swear, hungover or not, and I'll be in this rebellion. Because, you know, those capitalist pigs have to learn at the end of the day.
I have put a little note for my crowdfunder at the bottom there. You know, give what you can. It's for a good cause. For a good cause, lads. People.
Lucius for sure would have joined the YPG.
Oh, yeah.
He would be quite into that.
But yeah, so basically Paul Basquel, you know, he gets carted off as a slave to Rome. You know, we sort of get a bit of a rehash of the beats of the first film. Is, you know, he's got a few of his mates, few of his old rebellion mates. They're also gladiators.
I know you're not fucking here. Do you remember? Jaunty. Do you remember? Oh, you'd better be still word perfect. I want to hear the Brianstone chant from you, my friend.
Honestly, this guy, I don't even need a gladius. I've got a fucking weapon right here.
This one, the Wickhamist table right here in the corner. This is the fucking Wickhamist table.
You are sort of describing Stalingrad 3, I think. oh my god, no! Not you!
Jerry
didn't shoot you down as well, did they?
You fucking wanker! Oh,
bloody hell. Sit down here and have a sherry. Anyway, so they get carried off to Rome. We get we have our sort of Proximo figure of this movie, who's being played by Denzel Washington.
Who's bad, by the way? Who's a bad guy? He's not a good guy.
No, but you saw Well, you find out that he's a bad guy, sort of like nearly. Okay, we're slowly starting to stray into what annoyed me about this movie, which is that because you've got fucking Pedro Pascal who conquers Numidia, and then he goes back to Rome and he's got this triumph, and he's talking to gay Roman Jedward. And they're like, yeah, actually, we love that for you, that you conquered Numidia for us. But actually, we want you to conquer like all of these other places like Persia and India and stuff. And also we want you to just like genocide the actual fuck out of them. And then he's like, well, look, that's not very Roman, you know, of us to do that.
Christmassy of you.
I think really I'd like to spend a bit of time with my wife. I actually think you've got to treat the civilian population with good grace. And it's like, oh, okay, so Pedro Pascal is supposed to be a good guy. And the two gay little emperors are supposed to be the villain. And then this dynamic sort of continues where the gay little emperors are constantly like trying to get the gladiators to do like more violent fights to the death and stuff. And we're like, okay, they're the bad guys. Fine. They're the like kind of Nero / Caligula general. We like violence and we hate honor. And, you know,
we like violence, but not in a good way.
And then it sort of transpires that actually the bad guy is Denzel Washington, because he wants to kill them both and insert himself as emperor, which is bad because it's social climbing.
That is the implication.
The implication. Okay, this is gonna be my defense of this.
This is the angriest I've ever made, Patrick.
That only makes sense if you think that the movie has any sort of positive viewpoint about Rome whatsoever. Okay. And I think if you approach the movie thinking that it is genuinely asking and mostly answering no as to whether any of this is good, then it makes sense. So if you approach it from, they're still coming at it from the first movie's perspective of there's a dream that is Rome. They give them more credit than that. They deal with that in the first in the opening credits, they undo anything positive that the first movie has to say about Rome in the opening credits.
They do, and they have Lucius saying like, oh yeah, there's like the dream of Rome, but let me tell you, this like disgusting violence and like unchecked imperial expansion, this is Rome. And I think that does get a little bit undone by the fact that as soon as someone's like, you know what, you are the prince of Rome, and then he's like, oh well, if I'm the prince of Rome, then maybe the dream of Rome, maybe it is real. Maybe I will. Why shouldn't I have a dream of Rome? Why shouldn't I have one? It looks tasty.
But the end of the movie is not him saying there's a dream of Rome and it's good. The end of the movie is him looking up and being like, Jesus, all of that was really fucking bad. Is there anything here worth saving? That's literally the last line.
I didn't see the last 10 minutes because my version of it cut out.
Andrew Neil cut of the movie.
Yeah, I'm basing my information on a text message that I got off Andrew Neil.
Yeah, the literal closing shot of the movie is him being like, this is pretty fucked up. That's basically the end of the movie. And so I don't like, in its defense, again, I cannot believe that I'm going to to defend fucking Gladiator 2 of all movies. I think it deserves a little more credit than that. Like, I think you can criticize the performances. I think you can criticize many of the choices that were made. But I think its fundamental message and approach to the subject matter are so deeply ambivalent that it's impossible to answer yes with a straight face, that yes, it thinks there's anything redeeming about Rome at all.
It's the Gladiator film that's set in a summer camp.
Yeah, I mean, I think this came up on our episode about Gladiator 1, where I was like, look, these movies, they're supposed to be fun. I have no issue with the movie just being fun.
Yeah.
And my main beef with this movie was not really any kind of moral stance that it took on Rome, but just the fact that every new element of the plot, I was like, what? How am I supposed to care about this now?
What's happening?
I don't care about Paul Mescal. I'm 100%
on board with that.
Yeah.
I do take your point that there is a kind of sense of futility at the end there. But I do think that Lucilla is supposed to be a good character. I think that Acacius is meant to be a kind of a kind of complicated character. But I think Lucilla is supposed to be kind of good in a sort of uncomplicated, unalloyed kind of way. If only because she is a woman and Ridley Scott can't be bothered to write her. So the fact that Denzel Hooper-Ings betrays her to Skins Series 6 and then ultimately is responsible for her death, I feel like you're meant to take something from that about whether or not he's a good guy.
Yeah, because again, of course, Lucilla... Sorry, go on.
He's definitely the bad guy. I'm not saying he's not the villain, but he's a villain in the sense that Killmonger is a villain in Black Panther.
Sure.
Like the best villains, or villains who are worth putting on screen or on the page, have a point. You know, they're not just bad for the sake of being bad. And that's the weakness of the first Gladiator movie, is that as good a character as Commodus is, as well as he's played by Joaquin Phoenix, he's not making a bigger point about the world that they're living in. Right. And so Denzel Washington, who I think is having the fucking time of his life here.
Oh yeah.
Like that.
Oh yeah.
He's chewing scenery every time he gets an opportunity to speak. Like I, he's not without reason in the way that he talks about Rome.
Oh yeah,
and his
yeah, whole, no, like, no, he's
Marcus
definitely,
Aurelius is bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, he's definitely like he's definitely got reasoning. And I think honestly, I think this is where you and I differ, Pat. I like a proper bad guy. I like a sack of shit. I don't want any fucking Marvel Comics universe shades
Shall
of gray.
Shall be despotic boy king.
Yeah, Just real fucking fuckheads. I want bad guys who are like just like fuckhead morons. That's what I want.
Yeah. And they gave us that with the gay emperors, but then they were like, no, they're not the villain actually.
Yeah.
Because they're not competent enough to be the villains. They just suck. Like you can't be a villain if you're completely incompetent. We need to see the villain doing competent things.
Yeah.
Like, but so yeah, I mean, none of this is a defense of any of the gaping plot holes or semi-baffling decisions that were made at different points in the making of this.
Sure.
But I enjoyed it as kind of a 2.5 hour gore fest that made me think a little bit about what Rome is and whether it's worthwhile. And like, if we're putting cultural depictions of Rome out there in the 21st century, I think you are doing a moral disservice to your audience to portray it in the way that the first Gladiator movie did.
Yeah.
And I think that's true of Empire in general, yeah. That like these things are not morally salvageable.
Hmm.
I don't think.
In that way, it's kind of even more interesting that they didn't go for the, you know, the sensual Mashalar white boy depiction of Paul Mescal, where he could have been like sort of, you know, anti-imperial and being like, well, you know, like there isn't a salvageable Rome, but maybe there is a more egalitarian Rome that we could start. Maybe there is something. I mean, as sort of historically absurd as that would be, there could have been sort of something that, I don't know. But I feel like in the movie, kind of in this midsection of the movie, there's a lot of like great set pieces. We get the fake naval battle in the Colosseum.
Oh, fucking rules.
Yeah. Which Annabelle could not believe was a thing that they actually did.
Yeah.
Albeit I'm sure not quite to the extent that it is depicted in the movie.
No sharks.
Yeah.
Unfortunately.
No. We do get people getting eaten by sharks. This is also, I think it's later in the movie where we get the kind of the weird, like the execution of Lucilla in the arena.
That's a fucking bizarre scene.
Yeah, where they also execute Derek Jacobi. He's back in this movie. Derek Jacobi looks like he has been in stasis since the first Gladiator film. The man, now he looked old in 2000, but he has not aged.
Yeah.
And he's playing the same, literally the same character. And I swear down, they gave him the same lines. Him and Lucilla are once again conspiring to restore the, you know, the rules-based order of Marcus Aurelius. They're once again involving a gladiator, although unfortunately on this occasion Derek Jacobi doesn't make it.
He does not.
I mean,
and neither does Lucilla.
I say this with the utmost respect. British queens age real well. Like there's if the Ian McKellen also aging like fine wine.
Yeah.
Looks fantastic. Doesn't look a day older than he did the first time he picked up the Gandalf staff. You know, Derek Jacobi, fantastic, looks great, amazing. Like I don't know what their skincare routine is, but it's fantastic. I'm a huge fan.
Picking up the Gandalf staff is actually a Victorian slur for gay from the University of Oxford.
I was unaware. So my apologies for anyone I've offended with that.
What, the hanky code where you've got the Gandalf the white and Gandalf the grey.
Yep.
That's how you...
Gandalf the bear, Gandalf the otter, Gandalf the twink. That was a long time ago, though.
It's been some time since Gandalf the twink. Yeah. Yeah. Doing a taxonomy of all the different Lord of the Rings ethnicities into the gay sort of pantheon.
Yeah, I think we know the Uruk-hai are bears. I think we can be pretty clear on that.
Yeah, meat is back on the menu where they're concerned.
I don't know. I mean, I feel like on the whole, this is not a classic movie. It's not a great movie. But if you're looking for a way to spend a couple hours that involves some pretty competently done on-screen violence, and you don't think that empires are necessarily good, you could do worse than this. There are worse ways to handle this.
You could watch Those About to Die, for example. for a kickoff. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You could watch fucking Megalopolis, which Jesus Christ,
they didn't even try with that movie.
Bizarre. I was trying to explain Megalopolis to my mother-in-law, who works in the film industry, and I could not find words to explain how bad it was. I'm like, everything about it is bad. She's like, well, how so? I'm like, everything. I can't do specifics. There's too many things. You're just overwhelmed.
You just need to watch it and find out. You found like the opposite of like those movies that are so great you can't explain them to someone. We've actually managed to find a movie so bad that you can't even explain what's bad about it. It's just like somehow every decision they made was the wrong one.
Yeah. In truly baffling ways. This is not that bad. And it's not great. I don't think in 10 years anybody's going to be like, you know what I really want to watch tonight? Fucking Gladiator 2. Yeah.
No, that's true. Okay, so I feel like we've addressed basically most of the plot. So
apart from the very end, which is that basically Denzel Washington he's killed both the little gay emperors, and then now he's trying to take over Rome using the Praetorian Guard, but Paul Mescal, again, it's the plot of the first movie. Paul Mescal has got a legion of soldiers outside Rome who were loyal to Pedro Pascal. He's now been killed. And then basically him and Denzel Washington have a little duel outside the city in between. This is where it gets a bit anime for me. There's something quite Final Fantasy about this.
Funny, because I have put another Lord of the Rings reference. And it's meant to be very Lord of the Rings like, but I don't really feel anything, and I'm extremely easy to manipulate. So why don't I feel anything?
Yeah. This is I mean, again, this is me, because the Gladiator 1, or even a worse movie than Gladiator 1, like Saving Private Ryan, but it still hits this. There's still that bit at the end of the movie where he cries at the at Tom Hanks's grave. And even though the movie is insane and it has the fucking the Southern guide saying Bible verses while he shoots people with a sniper rifle, there is
awesome.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
Fucking cool.
There's a purely dudes rock level of quality to it. Like if you try and pierce that kind of outer skin, there's nothing underneath that. It's a beach ball.
No.
But
yeah.
That is at least there. And this movie, but just that stuff, there's a hollowness to it. There isn't anything epic about the final confrontation. You're just like, oh.
But this is the thing for me, because I love a bit of swashbuckling, whether that be on land or in the water. It's sure. all swashbuckling.
And this movie has both, let's be fair.
It's got both. Yeah. Any kind of like sword in the air, everyone hollering, someone says a few sort of slightly memorable lines. Like that's always good as far as I'm concerned. This is what I mean about me being very manipulable. Like even if it doesn't really make sense, I am not very silent about my distaste for the Marvel Comics universe. But even so, like even when they're like they say something like, oh, they've said something cool, and I'm like, yeah. That doesn't make a lot of sense. That doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make it like the you know, my secret, I'm always angry, and you're like, yeah, I'm always, wait, hang on. Go back one, Bruce. That actually makes no fucking sense. That's illogical. And there was sort of, they try to do that in this, like, and I was sort of trying to kind of access the feeling of like the kind of the Riders of Rohan, like, you know, kind of coming down the mountain, like, you know, kind of hollering, you know, any kind, like, you know, the bit in Game of Thrones when Theon does the, we die today, brothers, that bit. And it's sick. Again, just trying to access it. And like, and it's very easy to make me feel that. And I didn't feel anything like it. We are running to time, so I'm just gonna share some of my stray observations. One of my notes just says, what are these boats, are they joking?
So that's actually real. It's off a little bit temporarily, but only because the Romans didn't really need a navy at that stage.
So they just had a kind of ceremonial navy.
Yeah, they didn't really need it, because, but technologically, those things did exist. They're just more a product of the Hellenistic period and the wars of the successors.
Interesting.
So ships with giant siege towers on them were a specialty of a guy named Demetrius the Besieger, who was the son of Demetrius Poliorcetes. Yeah, real guy. Fucking wild career, by the way. Super fascinating figure. But yeah, in the wars of the successors, when you have these massive professionalized armies kind of going to town on each other for several decades, it was a period of really intense military experimentation. And so those ships with siege towers built onto them and catapults on them and all that's real. That's absolutely exists.
Okay, I really like that. I also really like the idea of them being like, okay, so we're taking to the water, but we don't have a proper navy. Are we going to have to use the showboats? Yeah, we're going to have to use the showboats. But then the showboats like turn out all to be like decorated like they are at a fun fair. So there's just like a picture of like fucking Bugs Bunny on the side. Yep. Yeah, so I've put had a quote here from Caracalla and Gator, which one of them just says, "Oh, the people can eat war." And then I've just put, "Who are these two meant to be?" I have a prediction, which is that Acacius is going to get gladiated, but he doesn't. There's a comment on the on Lucius quoting Virgil, and the bit with the person saying, "A slave doesn't want freedom; he wants a slave to call his own." Which is a bit of Cicero, I believe. Then I've
so
got
a whole bit where they all start saying what we do in life echoes in eternity, and then everyone's going like, "Yeah, that sounds familiar." And it's like, you can't just act like the thing from the first movie is now this kind of like folklore catchphrase. Yeah. He only says it one time.
It was only 16 years ago. To put that into context, this is like people getting little moustache tattoos on their fingers for us. Yeah. This is what we're dealing with. Then I've got like, oh, Acacius is supposed to be a stepdad. That's Oedipal or like Hamlet-al. The emperors are a bit auntie-like.
They do have some auntie energy.
There's a bit when the emperors yell at Acacius, "No one will remember you. Your name will be forgotten," which is cute because it's making it seem like he was forgotten because of a specific damnatio and not because Ridley Scott made him up. The incumbent emperor before Septimius Severus, Caracalla and Gator's father, was called Didius, which I think is very funny.
Yeah. Great. Yeah. Princeps Didius or.
Oh, yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's the twink emperor. And then I've just got some, because I thought the flashback where Lucius is being sent away by Lucilla, I thought was a little bit redundant, seeing as we know who he is now. So we just assume that's what's happened. And then
Didius came to power after a feud with the rival general Magnus Parvi, who many suspect that he had killed under suspicious circumstances.
He also doesn't seem especially surprised to see his mother or to find out that she was married to Acacius. And I felt like that should have been a kind of a revelatory bit, but it wasn't. Then I've got a complaint about Paul Mescal's mincing, because he's sort of doing it in kind of Arthurian sort of skirt. Let no more blood be spilled in the name of tyranny, which I think is a fool's errand of a plan given the context. And then I've got finally the strength and honor line is meant to be stirring, but it sounds like a sign off used in a fascist Discord server.
yeah I don't think you can end with a better encapsulation than that. Yeah, there's gonna be
see you next week.
I think the fascists are not gonna love this. It's too ambivalent, though. I mean, they also love Warhammer 40K, and that could not possibly be less obvious about it, about the fact that this is all bad. So who knows? Maybe the fascists will pick this up. I think the nicest thing I can say is I don't hate it, and there were some things I liked.
Yeah, that's fair. That's even handed.
I mean, it's got some great looking dudes in it.
Yeah.
I think it's definitely a kind of meaningful. It's not a meaningful contribution to the Dudes Rock canon, but I do think it is a meaningful contribution to the putting great looking dudes in skirts. for specious reasons canon, which is, you know, my personal interest, of course.
It failed in a scholarly and romantic way to lacquer on the stirringness that, you know, Top Gun 2 managed to do. You know, Top Gun 2, insane plot, deranged. We're going to a war with Iran for some reason. Like, it doesn't make any sense, but you still, you, at the end, you're like, yeah.
Spoilers! I haven't seen it.
Oh, no, that's pretty obvious early on. They don't say it's Iran, but it's clearly meant to be Iran.
It's such a geographically distinct place that they go to. It's got, like, a beach and, like, a mountain on the beach.
Yeah, that's Iran. 100% Iran. Yeah, it could be anywhere else.
It's literally just Iran. They may as well just put a big sign saying, this is Iran. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I mean, what a movie. What more could we say?
All other things aside, I want to ask you guys one more question.
Okay.
Are you not glad that this exists?
Are you not entertained?
Were you not entertained?
Yeah. Are you, like, if you had the choice between this movie existing and not existing, aren't you kind of happy that this is a thing that's out there?
This is tough. I'm not very selective.
Yeah.
I'm not an action movie prude. I like, if this had given me even the thinnest Dude's Rock gruel, I would have enjoyed it.
Yeah.
If it had given me something to latch onto to give you a bosh. Like, but it just, I don't know.
I feel like it's a
missed opportunity. Like, the original Gladiator is such a great example of that. And even just like the lines, I think what Phoebe was saying about the making strength and honor sound like a sign off from a fascist Discord server. Like, yeah, it's true. Like there's nothing, there's no like, the frost sometimes makes the blade stick. And part of that is...
That was the fucking coolest line ever.
There's not even an are you not entertained? And there's definitely not a my name is Paul Mescal. I love a girl with a fringe.
My name is... Well, actually, there's some confusion about that. I'm just finding out now that actually, until the age of 12, an age which any normal person would absolutely remember
vividly...
There's just
a massive, like honestly, and this is a plot hole that could be explained in literally like one line, or like even like they could have just shown him being like bonked on the head.
Yeah.
Or something.
And then he suddenly remembers like notebook style.
Yeah. And then he's like, oh yeah, hi mum.
Yeah.
How's it going?
Or he was pretending not to know who she was. I don't know. Either way, it's bizarre.
As with all of these properties, could we have improved it through our participation? Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, we could have.
Hire us. That's the monetization strategy for the podcast, actually.
When you're making an
ancient world movie, get us involved.
That's how I would have been. I'd have made it a musical. Or at least choreographed a number at the end.
Yeah, that could be give it the old Joker 2 treatment.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
All right. Well, that's about all we have time for. On that bombshell. We all have lives to lead. If you're listening to this, thank you very much for being a Patreon subscriber. You're the best. There will be another episode next week on the free feed and so on and so forth. You understand how it works. Thank you. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.